Welcome back. It is so wonderful to be learning today. Today we're going to be learning on the topic of understanding the Malbim, understanding one of the most formidable and incredible commentators on the Torah together. And I want to take a moment to thank Yossi and Esti, who are sponsoring today as we celebrate with them on the birth of a grandson to Merav and Aaron Watson, Be'ezrat Hashem. He should enter the Bevrisai Shel Avraham Avinu Be'itoy Uvizmano. Mazal Tov. What a very, very special time. Thank you for sharing your celebration with us. And boys, so we're going to learn about the incredible life of Rav Meir Leibush Ben Yechiel Michal Weiser, also known as the Malbim by his acronym. A remarkable person, a person who lived a very difficult, very challenging life. At the same time, it gave us a legacy and a history which has shaped and changed the way that we view the entire world. Certainly myself, at least. So the Malbim is remarkable. He was born in the Ukraine, and he lived a very difficult life. His father died at a young age. His stepfather ultimately actually taught him. He was, at a very young age, was already considered an Ilui, considered a genius, as I'm sure you will share with me as we go further. There's nothing short of a genius. But he had a difficult life. So he actually, he was involved in the rabbinate in a trial in Poland, first in Reschen and later on in Kempen. In Kempen, he was there for 17 years. So that was actually a golden period in his life. He is known as many people, De Kempener Magid. That's how he was known as. That's where his ultimate rabbinate really was. Unfortunately, he got married at a very young age and had two children and was divorced. So he had these two children. Later on, he got married to a lady by the name of Chaya. And he had one child. That child died, and his wife was also suffered from, at least the Encyclopedia Torah describes, depressive stages during her life. He lived a complex life. It wasn't simple. Wasn't easy, and it became less easy when it became to his public persona. He moved. He was invited by the Jewish community of Bucharest to become the chief rabbi of the area of Romania. Again, the countries were sort of being formed at this point in time, right? Every little country, every nationality is sort of getting its own little space. He moved into Bucharest, and it became a very complicated time because dealing with the same issues that we saw Rav Hirsch dealing with, the same issues that Rav Yaakov C. Mecklenburg, the Ksava Kabbalah dealing with, we started dealing with the issue of reform as it sort of filtered through from the Western European countries like France and Germany into the Eastern European countries like Romania, which is where we're dealing with. And although at the beginning many of the we'll call leadership of Eastern European Jewry did not feel that these Western ideas would infiltrate and have an impact in the East, they did. They did make very serious inroads, and certainly to countries like Romania and Bucharest specifically. When he arrived there, there were a number of things that he got very involved with. So for instance, they were in the middle building what was called the Choral Temple of Bucharest. You can go visit today, it's a tourist site. Massive thing, a church. I put the picture of it. It's a shul which looks like a church. That's essentially what it is, right? That was what they were trying to do. Right, they were trying to make Judaism more like Christianity, more like the grandiose of that was as the Jews, as the ghetto walls fell down, the Jews became more integrated. As they became more integrated, they wanted to be more like those around them. And this choral temple was in the process of being built in Bucharest, and he, as a chief rabbi, stopped it being built. Right, you can imagine that went down very well. And the next thing he also did was he stopped funding to the schools that taught secular studies as well. He believed that he wanted to slow the process of assimilation. And of course, that also did not go over very well. Another aspect of it was that he spoke in Yiddish. And of course, this part of the area, again, it was being divided. Poland is sort of being divided into these smaller countries. And there was the Prussian side, which was sort of the German influence. And there's the Russian side. And this, the German was the lingua franca. This is what was being spoken right here, and he was seen as a backwards person because he still really hung on to the Yiddish of Eastern Europe as well. He was also very makbid on kashrus, which is always the third rail. It's the perfect combination of religious regulation on financial gain, right? Which is like, you know, and for people who think it's all Baba Mises in general, so why is the rabbi taking away money from us? You know, that's religious coercion, nothing has changed. And so having done this, he angered both the reforming Jews, and he also angered the Hasidic Jews, because he was also modern in other ways, in the sense that he taught the Hebrew language, and he was very, very, very much into studies. He was into philosophy. He read Kant. He read science journals of the time. So the Hasidic community wanted to run him out of town. The reforming community ran him out of town, and sort of the middle always gives way, right? And so after a number of years, just 2 years in Bucharest, those on the left, the reforming Jews, slandered him to the authorities and said that he was gestating problems with the government, because remember, the government was feeding the schools. He was a implement of the government, in the sense, because he was the chief rabbi and he was stopping the funding. So the way that it was slandered is he was trying to stop the progress of integration, which is what the government was interested in. And it led to his first day, they stopped him speaking. The government declared he couldn't give sermons. He was there, he appealed that, he got the permission, and then he got up and he really talked about the people who who did that to him, and the government had him, and then they got him arrested. Right? And after he was arrested, he made a plea. So Moses Montefiore was involved in his release, but his release was on condition that he'd be expelled from Romania. And so he went to the Ottoman Empire, to the Sultan, to appeal the decision without success. He went to Paris to appeal the decision, and it was without success. He did receive reparations from Romania, but on condition that he would never enter Romania again. So we can imagine this is not a simple life that he's leading. In fact, he writes in the Levanon Journal, when he's in Paris, the following words on the bottom of page 2. It was on the eve of the Shabbos, which we read, "Remember what Amalek did to you? When the agents of the police came, and by the order of the minister, they surrounded my house on every side. They took me by force and cast me into the wagon and the cage which they brought, and the entire battalion, all the police captains and all the guards, armed men and the patrolmen and the cooks of their servants and their dogs, surrounded the cage on every side. It was treatment normally accorded to one of the thieves or murderers who are infamous and notorious throughout the land." So that's how the chief rabbi was arrested in Bucharest. And then he describes, this was by the hand of the adversaries from among our own people. They were the ones who destroyed our temple and sold their own brothers into the hands of their adversaries who shunned them. I mean, you can imagine he's very, very bitter about this episode in his life. And he never really reclaimed his stature afterwards. He bounced around from place to place. A little bit here, a little bit there. There was a period in time where his father-in-law passed away, and he went with his wife, and they sort of tried to work in the business there, but unfortunately through a bad partnership in the business that his wife took over, that failed, and he had to return to the rabbinate. And he spent a little bit of time in Königsberg, actually, after the Ksava Kabbalah, right? So he took over the post after the Ksava Kabbalah for a few years, but nothing really ever lasted, and ultimately he died on Rosh Hashanah, as passing through Kiev on the way to a new post that he was being offered. You know, you can turbulent, very tumultuous life, which is amazing, because all the people, you know, who lived at his time, who were against him, probably thought they won. But you know what? We don't know anything about that. Meaning, most your average person who thinks about the Malam doesn't know any of this. What did they know? They know Toras Chaim. They know what he wrote, which means to say he succeeded, but it wasn't in the realm of dealing with the people. It was in the realm of ideas. Which is a very hopeful thing for those who have to go through that sometimes. It's sometimes dealing with the complexities of on the street is much more complicated, but what ultimately lasts is the ideas that are produced as well. He wrote amazing things. He wrote so many, many books. Most people are not aware of the fact that every book he wrote on Tanakh has a different name. We all call them Malbim. That's not what he wrote. Right, so for instance, he wrote Igeres HaPurim, always on Esther. He wrote Gei Chizayon on the Treasar, Tfilas David on Tehillim, Leiv Melachim on Melachim, Yimei Kedem on Divrei Yamim, Chazon Yeshayahu on Yeshayahu, Divar Shmuel on Shmuel. Every book was called a different name. So he had different names for the different books that he wrote, and he did an incredible service to Klal Yisrael. We're going to see a little bit of some of the ideas that he wrote. So let's just start at the beginning. At the beginning, when he started writing, he did not write on Tanakh. He was a Eloi. He was of the Lithuanian world, not the Hasidic world, not the Reform world. He was that middle space of the realm of intellectual brilliance. He was writing on Shulchan Aruch. He wrote a book called Artos Achayim, which was his commentary to the first section of Aruch Chaim. He is quoted by the Mishnah Berurah no less than 200 times in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch. He was the classic Rosh Yeshiva Rav who knows everything in halacha. That's what he was. And if you listen to his introduction in Artzos Achayim, which is his sefer he wrote before you turn to Tanakh, I would like to quote one paragraph from it in source 2, where he says there's the cover page, by the way, of Artzos Achayim, which literally means the lands of life. He says the following, the second paragraph in source 2, Yomim Rabim, for many days, Al sirah iyun batach betach badad yashavti becheder horasi. I put myself in a cloise. I stayed by myself to consider, to think about these ideas. Sham v'kriyas sefer gulois mayim chayim locality. I managed to conquer the pits of water, the well springs of wisdom. Uve eshkalois yivain choymen lo yiskaalti. Poyeshev poba oel po betzela chokmo betzel shakaila netzach ki ivisia. I sat in the shade of God and I desire just to be involved and subsumed in wisdom. This is what he wants to do. He wants to spend his life writing and illuminating the ideas for the intellectually elite. He's going to read and write about halacha. He's going to read and write on the highest level of Jewish academic academic halacha. That's what he wants to do. And that was his pathway in life. And that stopped. That was the last book he wrote on Shulchan Aruch. And then he pivoted to Tanakh. Why? He tells us why. This is besides for his battles about policy and implementation and choral temples and shchita and all the things that he had to deal with and all the punishment he got for trying to make things better. Here is what, there was another battle that was going on. And this is the battle in ideas. And here's how he describes it. He describes it in terms of the context. He writes a commentary on Megillas Esther. It's called Igeres HaPurim. He writes a commentary on Yeshayahu called Chazon Yeshayahu. And then he writes a pirush on Vayikra. That's where he started. It's called, and this pirush on Vayikra is called HaTorah VaMitzvah, the Torah, the teachings and the commandments. And he says he writes in it an introduction called Ayelet HaShachar. This is where it all starts. Ayelet HaShachar means the dawn star. This is where he starts his real pirush, not in Bereishis, but in Ayelet HaShachar. And I'd like to quote you his introduction to Ayelet HaShachar. It is a must read. Here's what he says in the middle of his introduction. There's a lot of poetry, but now we get to the tachlis of what he says. In source 3, this is so important. Vahi bishnas taf taf ha taf resh dalet. That is 1844. It is in the year 1844, li yitzira, from our creation, kol kechola shamanu tzara kamevachira. I heard this terrible cry. A terrible cry, this plaintive cry, call out, call Toras Hashem tafiach kapeo v'dimasa alecheya ki bogdu bar re'eha. The Torah is calling out. Its tears are upon its cheek. Of course, these are all modified psukim that he's using as his poetry. The Torah is calling out because her friends have rebelled against her, betrayed her. Ki nivaru ksas roye ashkenaz ves Hashem no'atsu, because the number of the teachers, the shepherds of Germany, have come together and cursed her. Vayisasvu lahafer das v'chukim al tzufunav v'hisya'atsu, and they gathered to annul the laws of the Torah itself. Vayalu ro'im rabim haro'im v'ochlim es tzon marisom, and these shepherds came together to eat the flocks they were supposed to be guarding. that's how he's describing whom? The reformed rabbis, right? The shepherds have come to eat the sheep they were guarding. That's what he's describing. He says Yechanu es atzmon rabbanim v'darshanim gam chazanim. He says they call themselves rabbis. They call themselves cantors. He says v'zochei adosan, but they really are sacrificing their communities. Kol ele chavru el ir. Anybody know what the next word is then? Brunswick or Brunswick. They all came to the Brunswick, by the way, is using the language of Lech Lecha, of the Emirat of the four and five kings. Al Emek HaSidim, right, to the valley of the city. It's this description. V'yispoitetzu hakadim harekim v'yisra'u alapidim. And they broke the empty vessels to show their flames. So this was an ambush using the language by? Gidon. This is the language by Gideon in Sefer Shoftim, Perek Vav, where there was a surprise attack of the Jews. The Israelites, they had torches in the containers. They broke the containers. Now the light appears and suddenly everybody's attacked, right? They broke the empty vessels, and the empty vessels meaning their minds, right? I mean, they broke the empty vessels to show the flames, and now suddenly we're surrounded by this ambush. And now these small foxes with flames or torches attached to the tail, reference to Shimshon. You know, again, like just everything over here is all biblical, right? He says, again, apostate from Mishpatim. Thank you. So you see what he's doing here, right? So he says, and these are foxes. And a fox is a small animal. In the books, you assume is big. They're very small animals. They're not taller than our knees. Right, so the fox has torches on its tail, so it's now let to go in the field like Shimshon, and what happens is it burns down all the fields, right? So he says they're small fry, but they're making big damage. He says vativar mehechal Hashem vativar beina beabadim vataleides aron abris vatomel hashchis esluchas avanim. They're trying to destroy the Torah and even the tablets of the covenant. Okay, and he says at that time, at this time, I realize this is a time to do for God, and I need to respond to this. So he's responding to the Brunswick Conference. What is the Brunswick Conference, by the way? So just quick flip over the page. Brunswick Conference was held in June 12th to 19. It was the Synod. It was one of the many conferences held by Reform Jewry. This one happened to be in Brunswick, but there were multiple ones throughout the course. This is the one he's responding to. At this particular conference, here was the agenda. So first of all, the purpose of the conference, they declared, was to consider the ways and means of preservation of Jewry, of Judaism, and awakening the religious spirit. Again, the general view of Reform Jewry is that Judaism is on the downswing. Everything is going to disappear. And so therefore, let's make it more accessible, make it more related to the people of the times. That's their way of saying it. So it's seen as a positive thing, and no doubt in their minds it probably was. But here are some of the resolutions. The oath of a Jew is binding without any further ceremony than the invocation of the name of God. So what's being removed there? Bris Milah, right. So that means to say is that it's no longer so difficult to be a Jew. No, none of these medical adjustments needed for the men, right? Just say, I believe in God, that's sufficient. That's the sufficient, meaning lowering the bar of access. The prayer Kol Nidre is unessential, and the members of the conference were to take steps to abolish it on the following Day of Atonement. So Kol Nidre is being abolished. And then that's not the most serious of the things that are being done over here. And then it endorsed the response of the French Sanhedrin. Maybe we'll get a chance to deal with what the French Sanhedrin is, Napoleon's Sanhedrin. Fascinating topic in and of itself. Okay, this is as the ghetto walls are falling, a new leadership cohort in Israel. They agree with the response of the French Sanhedrin. And this is what they said. This is the amendment they made to it. The marriage of a Jew to a Christian, in fact, the marriage of a Jew to the adherent of any monotheistic religion is not forbidden if the civil law permits the parents to raise in the Jewish religion the children issued from such a union. By the way, just a quick statistical thing today. A Jew marrying a non-Jew, what is the statistical outcome? How likely is it they're going to marry, bring up their children with Jewish culture? It's a 25% chance. So it's 1 in 4 chance. Okay, so just that is what is being showed, right? So it's true, but the idea, this is where the idea was. Yeah, meaning we see today the outcome of that. Right now, the intermarriage rate in America outside of Orthodox Judaism is 74%, according to the Pew report, which means 1 in 4 is marrying Jewish. And of those who marry Jewish, right, who marry non-Jewish, the likelihood of Jewish culture being preserved is less than 25%. So you can just do the statistics. There's a terrifying outcome of what was intended to be, you know, preserving Judaism. The Malbim obviously saw that, right? But at the time, this is what they were trying to do to preserve Judaism. Hemorrhage is not a word that even helps fit what the outcome of this as well. So this is what's being described. He's reacting to what's being, and that's what he means. They're eating their congregations, meaning they're destroying the concepts which allow Judaism to continue. And in and among that was also the attack on the Torah Sheba Al Peh, as the Ksava Kabbalah is responding to, is they're basically saying all the laws which the rabbis are telling us, these rabbis who just made up all this nonsense, right? It's a tradition of 3,300 years. No, it's they made it up. We said we can carry on as well. And the Torah itself is like a Greek mythology, right? It's like one of those ancient books which kind of like, you know, has idiosyncrasies in it. So we don't really need to take it so seriously. It's like, it's nice, culturally very, very nice to have like our epic of creation. But really, it's not so relevant. And certainly Chazal, you know, is a very nice opinion of antiquated rabbis of yesteryear. That's kind of what the view of it is, which is what the secular view is in general. And the Jews, as they are secularizing, are adopting that. So the Balaam says, okay, so let me just clear the air here, right? So I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. So he says in source 5, so he says, what am I supposed to do? In source 5, me'az azarti ki gibor chalatzai v'achiloisi lechaber chaburai al tanach. So I therefore decided it's the time to start writing on Tanakh to explain our book, to explain our values, to explain what we're talking about, to defend against this as well. I've already explained how I'm going to do this in my introduction to the book of Yeshayahu. I'm skipping to the top of the next page. It's the second column of the source 5. I'm going to explain. I'm going to prove to you that the oral Torah was given from heaven. I'm going to show you that, O reader, that if you were to be serious enough, you were to understand that the oral Torah is an automatic outcome of the Torah Shebichtav. Understand how this is different to Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch is dealing with the same issue, but he deals with it quite differently. Rav Hirsch now in Frankfurt am Main is doing the same thing, but he says, when we learned this about Rav Hirsch, he was saying that the Torah Shebichtav is the lecture. The Torah Shebichtav is the lecture notes, which means the real thing was the lecture. That was Sinai, and that's passed through by tradition. The lecture notes are the Torah Shebichtav, so it's going to be a siman. It's a reminder of what happened at the lecture. But the Malbim is doing the opposite. The Malbim, in his defense of the Torah Shebichtav on the oral tradition, is saying like this. He's saying, if you were to really be educated sufficiently in Judaism, you would understand that everything is automatically derived from the Torah Shebichtav. That's where it's at, right? I mean, the Torah Shebichtav is the base, the foundation of all the ideas which are going to naturally stem from it. I don't understand or see them. Well, you haven't learned it hard enough to understand the rules of reading this book, right? You simply aren't educated enough to make a decision about this. Now, he's going to explain what this means. So he says, how am I going to do this? This is an amazing feat, he's saying. He's saying everything that Chazal said is mukhrach, it is perforce, the only interpretation of the Torah. Well, how does he get there? He says, on top of page 5, v'hine, pratei hadrachim ha-nesivos asher dorachti b'chlal ha-chibur. The ways that I'm writing in this essay, Haloihem, Kesuvim, V'aruchim, Bagdamas, Ashnia, Shekarasi, V'shem Ayat HaShachar. That is why I'm writing this book called The Dawn Star, Ayat HaShachar. Uba Asafti, Esaklalim, V'achukim, V'yesodos, Asher, Hayolo Chachamenu Zal, Ashebao, B'sima, B'sefer, Sifra, V'e Asher, Haim, Yesodia, Kabbalah, V'tor, Sheval Peh. I'm going to explain to you the rules of how to read the Torah to arrive at the Sifra. Now, just let me explain just what this means. When we say Medrash, we usually think, and there was a fantastical vision and a cloud and a river and a, right, we're thinking about all the, that's called Medrash Agada. That's very important. And there's a Medrash Rabbah, and there's a Tanchuma, and there's a Yalkut Shimoni, and Yalkut Raveni, and Yalkut Bachiri. Those are called Medrash Agada. That's fantastic. What we're referring to over here is the earlier type of Medrash, which is called Medrash Halacha. Medrash Halacha is essentially the basis before there was a Mishnah. This was essentially the Torah Shebaal Peh of Halacha. And the Medrash Halacha is called a different name, as an example. So the Medrash Halacha on Sefer Shmos is called Mechilta. The Medrash Halacha on Sefer Vayikra is called Sifra. Medrash Halacha and Bamidbar. And on Bidavarim is called Sifrei. If you go to this, the students of Rabbi Akiva, this is before we have the Mishnah. The students of Rabbi Akiva were the authors or the redactors of these corpus of material which came before the Mishnah. And that's what he's saying. This is where the Torah Shebaal Peh in Halacha comes from. So he says the following. I'm going to explain to you, I'm writing a Pirush, not on the Torah, but on the Sifra. I'm writing a pirush on the Medrash Halacha to demonstrate that a halachic norm which was derived by Chazal is automatically connected to the text if you were to only understand the text correctly. How do you understand this? He says, well, I wrote an introduction with rules. And he writes 613 universal rules for reading Tanakh, which he will apply everywhere he goes. That is crazy, folks. Do you understand? Do you know what he's just done? He's giving us a roadmap of how to read Tanakh. I'll just give you a few examples. I'm quoting. Here's the first rule. Ready this for this? The first rule, I didn't put into our sources. The first rule is, he says that Chazal understand, based on the sensitivity to the language, that there is only three-letter roots in the Tanakh. And then he goes on to deal in the next few rules with the exceptions of four and two-letter rules in words. And if there's a two-letter root, what's the third letter? Is it dropped? Is it not dropped? So basic rule, how many letters are there per root? And like another example, just like later on, this is rule 85 of 613. Yesh Hevdel ben HaMispar Yis HaSidori, Shlishi Revi'i Chamishi, VaMispar HaChalaki, Shlishit Revi'it Chamishit. Did you ever notice that? There's a difference between Revi'i, Shlishi and Shlishit. So he makes a point that the Torah actually uses those words differently because one is describing parts of a whole, the other one is describing a sequence. Meaning you need to know that if you want to read the Torah, right? So he's going to do that 613 rules of reading the Torah, which you will apply universally across it. Which means if you don't understand why the Medrash decided in Halacha, that why did Chazal arrive at this rule, it's because you didn't know how to read the Torah, right? So get educated a little bit, understand how it's working, and now you understand that the natural outcome is only this. By the way, this explains something really important. If you read the Malbim's introduction to Sefer Yirmiyahu, his pirush on Yirmiyahu is called Tochachas Yirmiyah. That's the name of his pirush. So he starts off with an incredible diatribe against the Abarbanel, which is fascinating because the Malbim actually patterns his pirush after Don Yitzhak Abarbanel. Right, he uses the Abarbanel as the format because he asks a bunch of questions, and then he thematically sizes off different areas, and then he explains it, and he speaks in the language of the Abarbanel. He uses the Abarbanel as the format, but he disagrees on a number of things. One of the things he disagrees with is the Abarbanel's observation in Yirmiyahu. What does he say? The Abarbanel says that if you look at the language of Yirmiyahu versus Yeshayahu, there's a vast difference. Anybody who's learned Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu will know it's much easier to learn Yirmiyahu than it is to learn Yeshayahu in language. No, not in other ways, it's not. Yirmiyahu is not in sequence. The book is not in sequence of chronology. Yeshayahu is more that way. But Yeshayahu is poetic. Yeshayahu flows. Yeshayahu is wonderful. It's very hard to understand poetry. Yirmiyahu is very precise. It's just what it is. In fact, there are many kriya ksivs. Right, that means to say there's things that are written one way and said a different way in Yirmiyahu, says the Abarbanel, because Yirmiyahu became a prophet at a very young age, and he was not as schooled, he was not as poetic, he was more rudimentary, and he made mistakes in the way he wrote, because he was younger. Which means to say that it's reflective of a less educated prophet, right? Not because the ideas he was being told were less meaningful, but the way he expressed them was different, says the Malbim. Under no circumstances! Right? And his entire introduction to Sefer Yirmiyahu is Abarbanel. Every word God gave to the Navi is, in fact, the way he gave it. Right? Now, this gets into a very interesting discussion, is the personality of the Navi. How important and consequential is the personality? I once asked one of my teachers, Rav Chaim Angel, this question. Is it that God will speak differently to different prophets based on their personality, or God will speak the same, but they interpret it differently based on their personality? His answer was yes. Right? That's the debate. That's the debate over here. Right? But why is that sensitivity? Because let's go to his introduction of Sefer Yeshayahu to just appreciate this. He explains the basic rules with which he's going to explain Tanakh. Where did I put this? Here, take a look at source 12. He says the following. He says in his principles of Tanakh, he says, number one, in source 12, bottom page 6. Amudei HaTanach HaShe Pirush Nishana Aleihem Hem Shosh. There's three rules. Number one is, Lo Nimtza B'Litzus HaVeNeviim Kefel Yinyan B'Limin Shonos. There is no repetition in different words. There's no poetry. This is like, oh, it's nice this way and not that way, right? There's no repetition. Lo Kefel Yinyan, No repeating of ideas. Lo kefil ma'amar, no repeating of phrases. Lo kefil militza, no repeating of advice. Lo shnei mishpatim she'inyanam echad. There's no two sentences which mean the same thing. Lo shnei mishalim hadishanim shal echad. No two metaphors with one outcome. Meaning everything is precise. And then he goes on skipping the second rule, which is, but look at the third rule. Lo nitsa she'mibenitzos hanavim klipa beloy toich. There's no advice or idea given of Chazal, which is an outside without an inside. Meaning to say, everything has precision on the outside in terms of the frame where it's phrased, and meaning on the inside. So the idea of the Abarbanel, who says, hey, you know, Yirmiyahu, he spoke a little more muteramente. He was a younger boy. He says, Narani, I'm a young boy. That's unacceptable. I mean, but it fits into the world picture of the Malbim that everything works. Every word is precise. Let's look at some examples of how the Malbim does this. It's so profound. The Malbim looks at Tanakh through the prism of precision. So let's look at Midrash Halacha and then his Pirush on Tanakh itself without the Midrash Halacha there as well. In the realm of Halacha, as an example, just an example of back to page 5, source 7. The Torah says in Parashas Kedoshim, Lo yisasu avo b'mishpat, lo yisasu p'neidah, lo yisedar p'neigodol, v'tzedek tishpot amisecha. Right, you shall not render unfair decision. You shall do not favor the poor or show deference to the rich. Judge your kin fairly. Who is this talking to? Who's the audience of this verse? This is referring to judges, right? Because these are things that relate to judges. The Medrash Halacha, that's the Sifra, right, as quoted over there, gives a number of explanations. And at the end, it says, "Davar acher betzedek tishpot amisecha." Have you done? The first explanation is, don't shorten a litigant's speech. Let's say a litigant saying, "Well, you know what happened was, can you just cut to the chase?" Right? You're not allowed to do that because now they're gonna get confused and you're not gonna really hear them and they're gonna miss out details. That's explanation one of betzedek tishpot amisecha. In tzedek and righteousness, you judge your friend. The second thing he says is, "Davar acher betzedek tishpot amisecha." Have you done? Is kol adam lekav sochus. Judge everybody favorably, which now seems to be moving out of the explanation of the pasuk, which is not referring to a judge, but referring to a regular Joe looking at somebody else as well. So he explains, wait a second, the Torah has already told us, you're not allowed to pervert justice. So it can't be that you need to judge righteously saying don't do imperfect judgment, because that's already just said at the beginning of the pasuk. So it must be that it's referring to something else which could lead to a miscarriage of justice, which is being a little bit too short with the litigants. Then he says, Odrash, at the very bottom, this is the Malbim's Torah Vamitzah on page 5. Odrash Darash Masha Kosov, Betzedek Tishpot Misecha Beloshen Yachid. Why is it that it now turns and it says, at the beginning of the pasuk, it says, Lo Sa'asu Ovel Bamishpot. Do not plural do imperfection and justice. So that must be referring to the you plural, referring to judges. But now that it says in the plural language, Betzedek Tishpot Amisecha, yours, singular, it must mean that it's also telling the individual outside of the courtroom as well. Which means the language itself renders, it's not that Chazal said, you know, wouldn't it be nice just to add an extra idea over here, right? He's saying the language itself of the pasuk demonstrates that it needs to have this explanation. Similarly, in Sefer, this is the Parashas Mishpatim as an example. This is such a confusing pasuk. If you read this pasuk, it's just like you could spend years just in this pasuk. It says, "Lo yisiach harei rabim lerois." Do not follow the majority to do bad. "Lo yisah anel riv." Do not jump in on an argument. "Lintois," to make it go one way. "Acharei rabim lahatois." Follow the majority. So is it democracy or is it not democracy? I follow the most people. Yes, that's in the pasuk, but not to do ra'ah. But that's not democracy. Then I'm like, what is it? How does this work? It's an internal combustion, right? How does this pasuk work? It doesn't work, right? So Rashi says, no, the beginning of the pasuk refers to, let's say I have a hung din, right? So let's say I have a beis din of 23 and they're dealing with a situation and it goes 12-11, right? 12-11 to guilt. Says Rashi, that's the first part of the pasuk, lo siya acharei rabim lerois. I'm not allowed to create guilt based on a slim majority of one. I need two. But for the other way around, if it was 12-11 for innocence, I'm allowed to. That's acharei rabim lerois. And then Rashi says at the end of his explanation, he says, because of alzesh ein loshon amikra miyusha b'zeh alofanav. Rashi says it doesn't fit so well. Says the Malbim, wait a second, what do you mean it doesn't fit well, Rashi? He says, ulam midivrei ha-mechiltin, from the mechilta, which is of course the Midrash Halacha on Sefer Shmos, which is where he's writing, right? He says, "Lo maradzi shapirish shapirish kifi pshutoy shel mikra shetirgum unglus yonatan shemazikos shleit tia acharei remilorois." He says, Rashi, "Im tira rishoim matim mishpat vo'isim ra loy teilech achareim af shehem rabim sheze ein tzorich lelamdenu." What? You have a rabble outside that's trying to burn down the city hall. The Torah needs to tell you that you shouldn't follow them. Like that should be an obvious, right? Don't follow crazy crowds, right? It's not referring to evil people that you're not supposed to follow. It's referring to good people in the courtroom who are teaching you, who are trying to mate klapechova, which means they're doing a guilty verdict. And he says, and therefore that's what the middle of the pasuk means. Is let's say it's 11:11, and you're the last person to make a decision now. Don't be the one to tip the scale just because of the majority. Meaning, it's talking to the judges perforce. And he goes on to explain how the language all comes out to show you what Rashi quoted as Chazal. But Rashi says, "I don't understand how it fits in the pasuk." The Malbim's job is to expand how it fits in the pasuk. So the biggest job the Malbim's going to do is to take those 613 rules and go to every Midrash Halacha and explain how that Midrash Halacha actually applies directly from the pasukim based on the sensitivities of the language, letters, phraseology, and consistency across Tanakh. However, there's another aspect of the Rav Malbim, which is, let's say there's no Midrash Halacha. Let's say he's explaining in the areas of the Torah which is not mitzvah. It's narrative. It's agada, right? The Torah is telling us a story. In that case, the Malbim applies the same principles, but not defending Chazal, but in its sensitivity of what's really going on. So, as he pointed out, there's no words which are repeated. No concepts are repeated in the Tanakh. So you say, well, that's a big order. Let's look at a few examples, because it sounds like the Torah does. Here's a classic example. Parshas Vayechi. Yaakov Avinu is on his deathbed. He is giving the blessing or curse to Shimon and Levi, based on a number of things that happened. He says, "Arur apam ki az evrasam ki kashasa. Cursed be their anger, because it is brazen, and their anger, because it is harsh." The word anger is repeated twice there, right? But it's just a different word, right? Apam and evrasam. That's af and evra, two words for anger. So if you were, let's say, the Ibn Ezra or the Rashbam, you'd say, kefel ha'inyan b'milim shonos. This is the same idea, just expressed poetically, right? Bad anger, not good idea, and rhymes, and right, it works. But no, says the Malbim, no, not at all. They're different things. Af refers to the type of anger which is justified on the person who did it to you. Evra is rage, which goes beyond those who did it to you. And therefore, when it came to the city of Shechem as an example, read in Parshas Vayishlach, where Shimon and Levi were the protagonists who went about to exercise justice on the Shechem and Hamor, who abducted and abused Dina, that is Af. Evra is the rest of the population. They didn't. You can argue complicity, but in the end of the day, they didn't do that. That's Evra. Which means to say, now, the rest of Tanakh, the Malbim is going to say the same rules, which is Af and Evra mean different things. Af is anger on the person who was the antagonist, and Evra is beyond the antagonist. It's the collateral damage as well, which explains the pasuk now. Now, similarly, let's say when the Torah uses many languages of Slicha, and I thank Dr. Avigal Rock for these examples. These are just some, but they're really, really excellent examples. Is when it describes the Nislach, Hashem gives us forgiveness. What does it mean Hashem gives us forgiveness? So he points out that the word nislach is different to kapara as an example. Nislach means to say absolution, where there's nothing left of the sin. It's not that I'm bearing your sin and I'm kind of having patience and I'm not acting on it. Nislach means it's completely gone. And therefore that's why you'll notice, and this I never noticed at all, is there is no time in Tanakh where it describes a human being who's nislach for another person. Meaning to say, there's no human who's able to fully wipe away the sin without any residue or any effect left on them. This is not a human thing. We can be nice and we can be patient and we can be, you know, forbearing, but we don't have slicha. That is only HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What was that? Exactly. Mechila is a different word. So the Malbim says over here. Similar thing which explains a complicated situation. Bilam receives a motorcade of, you know, folks from Midian, and they're like, please come with us, please come with us, please come with us. And he speaks to God, and God says no. So he says no. So they come back again. Listen, we'll give you more and more and more and more. And he comes back to God, and God says, listen, if they ask you to go, you can go. He goes the next morning, mamish, like 5:30 in the morning, there he is, saddling his donkey, and out he goes. And it says, Vayicharav Hashem ki ra'achu. And Hashem gets angry. But wait a second, Hashem, you told him you can go, right, didn't you? Says the Malbim, yeah, but you have to look at the pronouns. Today you have to be careful about that, right? But in Tanakh, right before, when pronouns were still safe words to use, right? So it describes how it says, what does Hashem say? Hashem says, "Kum leich itam." When he woke up in the morning, he went and it says, "Vayicharav Hashem ki." It says, "Vayakum bilam baboker vayachosh vayleich im sorei Moav." Im or es. Im means, as the Malbim explains, sharing an ideology. Itam means separate in ideology, although alongside. It's kind of commuters on the train. We're, you know, commuters on the train, we don't share a fraternity, right? We just happen to be functionarily on the same, you know, train car. That's what he's saying. Go with them on the same train car. But he goes, no, I'm all ideologically in. That's imam, right? So now the rest of Tanakh, you have to go through the rest of Tanakh and see where the ims and the itos are. And appreciate that these are actually different ideologies describing it, which is why Hashem was angry. Not that he went, but he went with them as imam, not itam, which is what the permission was only given for functionary association, not for ideological connection as well, as an example. The examples amounts and amounts and amounts. The Malbim is not only does lends to this kind of precision with words, but he has these vast vistas of perspective on Tanakh, which shape the way that he views Tanakh, and they I'll call them principles. They're not just the way that he looks at the world; it's like principles. An example is let me finish this up, okay? And then we'll close. So just two principles that which are important. Miracles. We saw the Ralbag was very concerned about miracles in general because he understood that miracles had to operate within the confines of nature, within the confines of regular nature. So what does he do? So the Malbim says, so the Ralbag says, as an example, you can't have fire which is cold. You can't have a triangle which has less than 180 degrees in its angle. Right? God will not operate outside of that. He'll choose not to operate like that way. The Ralbag says, sorry, God will choose not to create yesh me'ayin, ex nihilo. But once God has created, Hashem can pivot anything he wants in the way he wants it as well. So you don't have to explain to me the air pressure about how the Jordan River split. Thank you very much, Ralbag. I'm very happy to say that he allowed the gravity to stop and the water to create a pillar and for it not to flow down. The Malbim does not belong in that rationalistic camp. He's very much more in the Kabbalistic camp when it comes to this as well. And you'll see a number of times where he'll bring Kabbalistic ideas in. In fact, he quotes in the beginning of Parshas Maaseh, the fascinating segula of Rav Shimshon of Astropoli, the 42 Maaseos. The Malbim explains that in the beginning of Maaseh. Fascinating as, in and of itself. There's another principle which is where our angel, or my teacher mentioned, I think it's a really, really profound rule, which is he calls it the Malbim principle, which is as follows. It's like you'll have prophecies that happen in Tanakh, which you didn't see the resolution or them coming into reality, into kinetic energy. So as an example, in Yeshayahu Perek Yud Aleph is a classic example. That's the example of the Yotzached Choter Migeza Yishav Netzer Misharashav Yifren. It goes on to describe the lion and the lamb and the, you know, in this whole messianic era, right? So all the Mepharshim try to debate. Yeshayahu gave us in the middle to the end of the first reign of the first temple, but we never saw this happen. So what was Yeshayahu referring to? And the Mepharshim are debating about this. Most of the Mepharshim say this refers to the Messianic era in the future. Says the Malbim, no, it may also, but the Malbim says that it referred to the era that applied in Chizkiyahu's time. And then again, there's other prophecies which applied at times of Shivas Tzion, and they missed the boat, which means Hashem was saying, this was an era with Messianic potential. You could click in, you could get into this moment, and they missed the moment, which means that it is possible to have a prophecy which has reality at the time that they're speaking and listening, but they didn't use the window. They didn't utilize that window. So you say, how could it be that that day we missed the Mashiach? Well, there was an era. There was an aura at that point in time where we could have entered. We missed it. And that happened at the time of Chizkiyahu Melech. That's what he's saying. Yeshayahu lived at the time of Chizkiyahu Melech. He was saying this because this could have been then, but it didn't. Now, there are other auras. By the way, the Malbim predicts times. These times as well. The Malbim in Sefer Daniel gives us when Mashiach will come and Tchias HaMesim will come based on that. And we miss them. And in the same way, that doesn't destroy his religion. And that doesn't destroy his belief system because not he missed them, but we missed them. that's the way he's saying it. I mean, you say that there is a degree of human action contributing towards the outcome of the prophecies, which means that a prophecy does not have to happen only one way. That's what he's saying, which is a Malim principle which applies itself across Tanakh and is very helpful in rereading Shivas Tzion, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. Why did Mashiach not come then? It sounds like if you read Zechariah Perek Dalet, which is the Haftarah of Chanukah, it was about to come. The answer is, says the Malim, it was. They just missed it. They didn't get on the train. Right, so that's a principle that has across Tanakh. I'd like to just do two observations, then I'm going to really have to leave. Two observations is the Malim was very, very, very well read. In all forms of science. So if you are interested, if you are in the persuasion of scientific reading, it's worthwhile reading the Malbim in his commentary on Tehillim, which is called Tefillah Estavid, which, again, you can't read Tehillim without it, and Perek Ches, in which he says, wait a second, listen to how Tehillim starts. It says, Hashem, you've created the heavens, your glory in heavens. And he goes and say, Ki yireh, shomecho maseh esposecho, shemesh yireh, et yireh v'kochavim asher kananta. Hashem, I'm looking at the heavens, I'm gazing at this, and like, my enosh kisis kerenu, v'enosh kisis kadeu. Hashem, we're so small, says the Malbim. You know, I've been reading astronomy recently, and I'm like, the argument in science is that we are infinitesimally small, right? And meaning that there's no point in the human existence because we are a small scrap of biological material on a very moderately sized rock, which is now, they've even described a new one called Uranus, right? That's what he describes, because they just discovered it in the turn of the 19th century. And he says, so what is our place over here? And then he goes into the notion of atachasreim atme elokim. What does it mean to be a human being? He says, you know, they tell us that that there are mammals that live in the water called whales. And he says, you know, and they nurse their young like a human being does, which means that we ultimately come from fish. And he says, wait a second, biologically that's incorrect. And he goes on to describe this, meaning to say, what's he addressing there? Evolution, right? So he addresses all of these things throughout his period. He's not a person who sticks his head in the sand and is ignorant to the realities that are surrounding him. His entire pirush of ches in Tehillim is related to these specifics. Just to appreciate this, I'd like to conclude just with one: how sensitivity leads to remarkable perspectives. And we've done this before, but I just want to make this observation. When you're sensitive to the words and you realize that the Torah is not just playing a game and the Torah is not just telling us now stories that we were told in first grade, you realize there's a lot more profanity. Here's an example. How many people were in jail with Yosef? How many people was Yosef conversing with at the end of Parshas Miketz? We're about to arrive at. We arrive there. So always there's the baker and the butler. Yeah, but that's not what the Torah says. You see, if you read it very carefully, there's Sarah Ofim and Sarah Mashkim, and there's the Mashke and the Ofer. That's four people. Which means to say, there was the officer, and there was the baker. There was the officer, and there was the butler. And in fact, Ishka Chalamoy Pasar means to say that they dreamt the dream of the one who was below them. Let's remember what was the problem? There was the tradition tells us that the Pharaoh was drinking, and he found a fly in his drink. Right, in his wine. And then he was eating and there was a pebble in his bread. Now let's think about this. There's four people over here. The officer is the one who presents it to the Pharaoh. That's the one who walks out in the robes and, you know, presents the cup. And there's the guy in the kitchen, you know, with the apron, and he's busy preparing the drinks and he's busy preparing the bread, right? So who is more liable in the case of the fly in the wine? Is it the guy in the kitchen or is it the guy in the hall? That's the guy in the hall. He should have looked in that cup. A fly is very easy to see in a cup. Who is liable for the pebble in the bread? The guy in the kitchen, right? And so he was pointing out that they dreamt, Ish Kachawa Pasar does not mean to say that they dreamt about each other's dream, butler and baker. It refers to the butler and the officer dreaming each other's dreams, which means the one who was more liable for the bread was the baker himself, not the officer. But the officer dreamt the dream of being killed, so he didn't understand, why am I being killed? I had no way of knowing. And what was Yosef resolving? Is that it wasn't your dream. It was the other guy's dream. Similarly, the guy who was presenting the cup saw that in fact he was going to be saved, but he said, but I'm responsible, I know this. No, it's the other guy that it's referring to. How does Malbim know this? Because he read it without the indoctrination, or so to speak, or the fact that we think that the words are the same. We automatically assume that the words are the same. Why? Because we've always read it that way. But you read it with a little more sensitivity and you appreciate there's a much more complex story which is unfolding based on what the Torah actually says itself. The Malbim does this time after time after time again. Why? Because he believes and he knows that the Torah is serious, that the Torah means things and it's not just repetition, and it's not just poetry. And therefore, when you read the Torah in that way, wow, you see the Torah in a completely different way. Right. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. It's such a fascinating topic.